Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. If you're interested in caves and have never been caving before, I would encourage you to seek out your local grotto. That's a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. Caving is a very different kind of activity, and it's great when you know what you're doing, but not so great when you don't. In fact, it can be downright dangerous if you're not prepared for it. So make friends with cavers, get them to take you on your first few trips. Most grottos have people who are great with beginners, and they'll show you a fun time underground to your skill and comfort level. You can find a grotto at the NSS website, caves.org, caves.org. My guest this month is Johanna Kovarik. I can't wait for you to hear it. We had such a great talk. She's got an extensive background, just a really impressive caver. More on her in just a few minutes. So I missed Sarah. I ended up staying in Indiana and caving with Scott Frosch and a crew down in Washington County, Indiana. We went to Fredericksburg Cave. It was my first trip in there. We went back to the lake in the back, which was so cool. I had my Swago in there and I had a wetsuit on, so I totally swam all around the lake floating on my Swago. I love swimming and floating in caves, so that was such a cool trip. Thank you, Scott, for the invite on that one. Great cave, great company. Everyone who was there, I love you all. What a great weekend. Of course, convention is this month down in Tennessee. I wish I could say I'm going, but work is picking up. I actually got a big promotion, details of which I might share sometime late in the next few months. But suffice to say, my work life is about to get busier in a very good way. But I'm sad to say I won't be making convention. I will, however, shamelessly promote my grotto's annual event, Indiana Cave Capers, August 2nd through the 4th at Crawford County Fairgrounds near Marengo, Indiana. Funny thing, I won't be there either. My wife is pregnant and the baby is due that weekend. So we'll either be at home with a fresh baby or waiting around for him to say, time to go. But either way, I'm busy, but I hope that you can come and see some of the great caves that Indiana has to offer. I promise you won't be disappointed. Real quick, a supporter of the show has asked me to speak briefly about karst conservation across the country in the show intro, and I want to talk this month about the Kentucky Karst Conservancy, whose big preserve is Big Bat Cave in north central Kentucky, and they've done some really interesting things in that cave. They're mapping it with LIDAR. If you go back to the Ken Bailey episode of the podcast, he talks a lot about it, and you can get involved with that as well. They need lots of help with that, and there's even an opportunity to log hours toward getting certified with the equipment and the processes. And if you're not interested in that, Big Bat is an incredible cave to just visit. My grotto has a close affiliation with the KKC, so we have some members who can take you down there and get you in so you can appreciate it. But the Kentucky Karst Conservancy is doing some really great things, and like all conservancies, they need your support. So visit the Kentucky Karst Conservancy website at KentuckyKarstConservancy.org. Easy to remember. You can go there to become a member or just to make a donation. Of course, volunteer time is always welcome as well. That LIDAR project is pretty involved and they need all the help they can get. But what an incredible reward it'll be when that project is done to be able to say you helped in some way, whether it was with your time or with your money. So again, support the KKC at KentuckyKarstConservancy.org. Okay, so Johanna, she was so great. I have a couple things to apologize for. First of all, she's done so much. I found my head spinning when I was talking to her, so I kind of jumped around a lot. I kind of wing these interviews, especially if I don't really know the person, but Johanna provided me with a few links, things to read, films to watch on things that she'd been involved with, and I did all that, but it was almost overload, and that's not her fault, it's mine. She's just done so much, and it was such an honor to ask her about all of it, but I was a little scatterbrained as a result, so forgive me if you notice that. She's worked in Carlsbad, she's been in Lechuguilla, Wautla, big caves in China, she worked as a guide on Prince of Wales Island at El Capitan Cave in southern Alaska. We cover a lot of that, but not nearly all of it. The second thing I want to apologize for was the audio quality of her line. You know, who knows how well an internet connection is going to go? Is it going to cooperate on any given day? Who knows? It wasn't terrible, but it's been better. I did a lot to clean it up on the edit, so I think it sounds pretty good, but just a heads up on that. Johanna was such a delight to talk to. I hope I get to hang out with her in person someday. This is Johanna Kovarik. What got you hooked on caving? Let's just go back to the beginning. What was your first caving trip?
So when I was in college, I got an internship through the Student Conservation Association, and I applied at a ton of different Park Service units, and I got a call in, I won't say the year, but I got a call from Ted Perkins, who worked at Carlsbad Caverns National Park, and the first thing he asked me was, how do you feel about elevators?
All right.
And I did not know because I didn't really know about Carlsbad. I grew up in Michigan, and so I knew about caves, but I had never really been to a cave before. And so I said, well, I'm okay with them, I guess. He was like, great, you're hired. And so I went down to Carlsbad, and I worked for the interpretation division of the Park Service down there. And that was my first time really experiencing caves. My first day there, they just let me walk into the natural entrance and then walk around the big room and come out, you know, and then they were kind of waiting for me when I came out, and they were like, so what did you think, you know? And my mind was just blown, obviously, because here I am so many years later still caving. But that was my first introduction to caves.
So Michigan, have you since, I mean, we're kind of sidetracking here, but have you since gone back? There's a little bit of karst in Michigan and like the UP, and there's some karst on Mackinac Island and things like that. Have you since done anything in your home state?
Yeah. So after my job there, my internship there in Carlsbad, I got a summer intern, or I got a real job with the Forest Service up in Alaska as a cave guide. But just after that, I went back to finish my undergraduate in Michigan. And, you know, I was nuts about caves and I was obsessed and trying to find any way to go caving that I could. And so I, you know, did what they tell you to do. I got in touch with the grottos there in Michigan. And so through Michigan Interlakes Grotto, I met some folks and went on a trip up to the Fiborne Karst Preserve and got to go in the cave there and met some of the cavers and hung out for the weekend and bothered them constantly for any other trips that they had. They didn't have a whole lot of active trips at that time, but I did get to go on that trip with them up to the Fiborne, which was really cool.
Where is that?
So it's in the, it's just across the bridge, as someone from Michigan would say, into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Do you know Tom Ray?
Yeah. So I think, and this is, I mean, it's been so long ago, but it was one of the younger guys in the grotto, younger guys. He was still older than me at the time. I drove up to like Traverse City and met him there. And then we carpooled up and I think it was Tom Ray and the other guy's name is like right at the tip of my tongue, who met us up there. And I actually ended up hanging out with them a bunch on the Fiborne that weekend.
Yeah, so, yeah. Because he's really, really active. I mean, he's an Indiana caver. I mean, he's an older gentleman. He was once NSS president, but he's an Indiana caver. And he's been really active in the Michigan Karst Conservancy up there and yeah, specifically in that area. So that's why I wondered. That's cool.
Yeah, and it was a total classic newbie trip in that, you know, I remember I had been caving in Alaska that summer, but I hadn't obviously been caving very prolifically at all. And so I had this like black cotton coverall suit that I got at a Army Navy surplus store, and I had a pair of extra tufts that I'd gotten in Alaska. And I remember before I went in the cave, they're like, oh, there's water in there. So they like duct taped the top of my boots to my pants. And I just remember being in there, and there were, you know, obviously very small cave. And so they knew, I'm sure it had been totally mapped out at that point. But, you know, I'd see a hole and I'd, oh, where does that go? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. You should go check it out. You know?
Yeah.
So total classic, you know, new caver caving trip. But it was really fun. And, you know, I think also very stereotypical for trips back in those days where it's like three older dudes and me just like hanging
right
out for the weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great experience, and they were super welcoming and more than willing to share their time and their knowledge about the Fiborne Karst Preserve and the cave with me. So it was a fun time.
All right, let's go back to Alaska. So you're already a cave guide in Alaska. Where were you?
So I was on Prince of Wales Island, which is part of the Tongass National Forest, which is southeast Alaska. And I had been asked to go up there towards the end of my internship at Carlsbad. The head of interp there approached me and asked, you know, if I had plans for the summer, which I did not. My plans were like bartending, you know, working.
Sure.
I, you know, I I knew how hard it was to get government jobs. And so I didn't have any huge expectations coming out of that internship. But he told me that he had a friend that was looking for an emergency hire to go up that summer and lead cave tours. And he said, so, you know, how do you feel about going to Alaska? And it was funny because, you know, since then, you know, I've lived in Alaska for kind of a while, and a lot of people dream of Alaska, right? They hear about Alaska. They always want to go. It's kind of part of their dream, you know, trip or job or whatever. But for me, for whatever reason, I just had no preconceived notions or ideas of Alaska. It was just like, oh, I've never thought about Alaska. That sounds awesome. Sure. So yeah, I went up there completely in a lot of ways unprepared and lived in a, so the guy that I talked to that was hiring the job up in Alaska kind of described it to me before I went up there. And he told me that I would be living in a trailer, probably by myself, but other, you know, employees might come and go and stay in the trailer as well. And I had thought that he meant like a single wide or a double wide, but when I got up there, it was a tow behind.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, I mean, they picked me up on the island. We shopped a grocery load of food and they drove me up there in the pouring rain and dumped me off in a tow behind trailer. And that was it.
Well, so, what was the first night like? It's almost like the first night in prison. What was that like? What is, was it like, what have I got myself into?
Yeah, I mean, I had done some outdoor stuff with my dad, but he was sick a lot of my life. So we didn't really get to do as much as I would have liked, or I think he would have liked to do. So, I mean, it was just a completely crazy experience. I was in the middle of nowhere. It was like a 2-hour drive on a dirt road, you know, away from the nearest small, very small town. And it was just hosing rain. And they had shown me really briefly how to run this giant generator thing that, you know, I mean, I just wasn't skilled in those sorts of things when I got there. And so it was exciting and awesome and in some ways terrifying. I'd never dealt with bears before.
Have you know, since? And then
I
had,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I live in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
This is part of it. But yeah, and then I had to give cave tours, right? And the cave was, I think it's 372 stairs up to the cave entrance. They have like a boardwalk and a decking built, which is really nice. And then they have cave tours. And so I had to go give a cave tour the next morning. So it was a pretty exciting time.
So you had been in the cave before, so you knew about the cave. Or you had?
No.
You hadn't. Okay, so you did. Wow. Wow, right into the fire. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was pretty crazy. But it had a gate on it. It had a really nice back gate on it, but it would warp a little bit. And so when I got up there, you know, they give me the keys and everything, but I couldn't get it open because it had kind of jammed shut and like I wasn't sure how to, you know, what the trick was. And so I just remember, I think it was two professional loggers that were working on the island that had come for a tour. And, you know, we walked up the stairs, we get it to the entrance. The gate is probably, I don't know, like 100 feet into the entrance, something like that. And so I'm telling them about caves while I'm hanging off of the gate and like banging on it, like trying to get it open. I don't remember. And like, I didn't have a uniform or anything, so they didn't give me a uniform, you know? And so I just remember the guy looking at me and he's like, do you know what you're doing? It's like, I totally know what I'm doing.
Well, guys, I'm curious about this whole thing, like every little aspect of this. So these were just loggers working in the area. Were you there to educate or were you there to just simply show people this particular cave? And this was a wild tour, right?
Yeah. So the program has grown a lot. And the program had started, you know, they built the decking and the boardwalk up to the cave, I think, in the, I think it was like mid-90s. And so, you know, there had been some cave guides before me, and obviously they're still running the program now, and it's, you know, they have uniforms, and there's more cave guides. At the time, it was just me. There wasn't anyone else. But the primary goal, you know, always, I think, for the Forest Service with those types of programs is education about the resource, you know, and we're a multi-use agency, so Forest Service is a multi-use agency, so, you know, they promote recreation as well as, you know, other uses, and conservation education is a big piece of that, understanding those different uses as well as your recreational opportunities, you know, providing forest visitors with an opportunity to explore their caves there on the island.
And was there one particular cave that you were assigned to show people?
It's El Capitan Cave on Prince of Wales Island, and it's on the northern end of the island. there's now a paved road that goes, I think, all the way up there. I believe they have pavement all the way up to El Cap now. And they run tours Memorial Day through Labor Day. And I believe they do them all week. The schedule kind of changes year to year, but there's information about it on the Tongass National Forest website. And so they've been running tours in that cave for a very long time now. I guess I should also say it is currently, I believe, still the longest mapped cave in Alaska. And I believe it's at, if I can remember correctly, it's just over like 2 miles of passage.
Oh, really? I mean, I know that a lot of Alaska is probably underexplored as far as caves are concerned, but that's surprising to me that it's only 2 miles.
A lot of the caves in Alaska tend to be deep. There's more deep caves in Alaska than there are long caves.
How interesting is that? And so this venture was it just that season? Was it just that May to August, or did you come back next the following year?
Yeah, so I fell in love with Alaska that season. I really enjoyed being up there. I enjoyed the solitude of being on the northern end of the island, but also the adventure of it. And then I also became really interested in the geology there, as well as the interactions between the land use there, the timber harvest, and the karst on the island and in Southeast Alaska. And so I became very interested in studying that in graduate school. And so I tried to come back the next year and it didn't quite work out, but then they brought me back later on. So I went back for another seasonal job doing the same thing, leading cave tours in July of that year. And then while I was there, I got an opportunity to work and talk with a forest geologist in Bechtel. And through those conversations, he hired me back as a geology technician, hydrology technician with the forest. And then I went on to do my master's studying up there.
And so this was a formative experience in so many ways. Not only are you solidifying your love of caves, but you're also gaining curiosity about the area and how to manage it and how it came to be the way that it is in its current state. And so then that sort of shaped your academic life after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was interesting was, you know, I didn't really get to go caving at all when I was down in New Mexico, other than, the wild cave tours that I went along as part of my job there at Carlsbad. But I really started caving in Alaska that first summer, you know, because I fell so in love with it when I was in Carlsbad. I hadn't really had the opportunity to go caving when I was there. That was the first thing I wanted to do when I got up to Alaska. And so with my first real paycheck, with my first real government job, I bought my first real set of vertical gear. And one of the guys that was there that was working as part of the geology field crew threw a rope up on a bridge up there by the cave and got me on rope. And so I started going out with him and mapping caves. And that was really my first caving experience was, here's one end of the tape. Go stand over there.
So you're talking about survey. And so you've done a lot of surveying and mapping and that sort of thing. What was your first real experience doing that? What was the cave and where has that taken you?
So I'm trying to remember. There were a couple of different caves on Prince of Wales that we did that summer. One of them I remember was Constantine's, which is a wet cave there again on northern Prince of Wales Island. And I was really fascinated by it, the process of data collection and then putting that data into a program and seeing what you've mapped and seeing what that means in terms of speleogenesis and where the water is going beneath the surface and what that means in terms of surface topography and then, what kind of impact that has on the plans for the surface in the area. I was just the way that whole thing works together and seeing, just seeing the cave passages beneath the surface after you've mapped them is just such a cool thing. And so, I kept at it. I learned how to draw cave maps, and I started doing that. And I've really mapped caves just all over the world as part of that passion and that interest. And so I guess for me, cave survey was the first step to really understanding caves. You document everything carefully as you survey. You learn more about the geology of the cave as well as the hydrology. You're moving slow enough that you're also able to document cave biology if you run into any kind of archaeological artifacts. fossils, all of those sorts of things kind of reveal themselves as you're drawing the cave map, as you're surveying. And I really enjoyed that piece of it.
So have you been like the chief cartographer on a number of maps? Like you drew the map?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my first projects in graduate school as part of my master's and working for the Hoffman Institute at Western was to map caves and put those caves together into a GIS, geographic information system, for the university on a biopreserve just kind of north of Mammoth Cave National Park. And so I had different graduate students I'd talk into coming out with me, and we'd map caves there, and then I had to kind of put all of that together for the university. But then also in Alaska, I mean, that was a big part of my job. So while I was working on my master's and after I finished, I worked for the Forest Service there on the Tongass, leading cave expeditions kind of around the island and in other spots just to map the caves and bring that into our inventory and cave database for the forest.
God, that's so cool. I have nothing more to say other than it's so cool that you got to do that essentially professionally. I mean, I hang out with people all the time who do it on the weekend. It's what they do to get away from their job. But for you, it is your job. And I mean, I'm sure that adds a different dynamic to it. And I'm sure that you've done some that have been outside of your professional work as well. But that's just really cool. So what, I guess cave maps have your name on it as sort of the chief cartographer. What are you proud of having done?
I guess I'm proud of all of my maps, you
know. Of course. But is there one in particular or two that sort of were a real challenge in one way or another?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. There aren't any that, the experience of leading the crews and, you know, that the different trips that we've gone in to map the cave, I guess, stand out to me in some ways more than the map itself. But I will say that I just took on Alashigiak, a section, and I think that that's probably going to be my biggest challenge to date.
Gosh, I cannot even imagine trying. I mean, first of all, getting to be in that cave, and also understanding what I know, which is not very much, about how that cave formed and how it's kind of a spaghetti bowl when you look down at it. I don't know. That just to me is an enigma and fascinating place. I'm sure you share that sentiment.
Yeah, for me, it was really exciting getting to go on my first Lechigia trip because I, you know, it was my first caving experience was being at Carlsbad. And I remember walking into the room where they had the morning meetings for all of the interp staff, and there were photographs of Lechigia up on the walls. And I remember being a young intern and looking at those photographs, and I asked somebody, you know, oh, is that in Carlsbad? And they're like, no, that's in Lechigia, and you'll never get to go there. You know, and just being like, oh, wow, you know. And then you know, some of the permanent employees that would cave in Lechigia, they'd have parties and things at their house, and sometimes we'd get invited and you get to meet some of the cavers that went in there. And so, you know, I think it's a big deal for a lot of U.S. cavers especially, but for me it was kind of poignant to be able to go. You know, that first camp trip that I did was pretty exciting, you know. And so each time you go, each time you get a chance to go in, whether you're leading your own trip or invited on somebody else's trip, when you have that opportunity, it feels like a special, special thing. You know, it always feels like an honor to be able to go.
How long were you underground for that particular trip?
Yeah, that first trip, I don't remember. It was probably 5 or 6 night camp trip.
Yeah. Do you remember where you were working?
Yeah. So it was actually, you just said you spoke with Hazel Barton. It was one of her trips.
Nice.
And it was in the deep seas area. So there were 12 of us women. It was one of her all women trips that we went in on. It was a whole week of surveying and just getting to cave with some really awesome women. And again, feeling just super incredibly humbled and excited to be part of that. It was just a really cool experience.
It's so funny that you mentioned Hazel, because it was when Hazel agreed to talk to me, she said, I'll do it on one condition. You talk to more female cavers. And I did not know that she led women only trips in Lechigia. That's so cool.
Yeah, she did. She did a couple of those. And I don't know actually how many she's done. There were two anyway. And I don't know that that was necessarily the point. It was more just all of the really awesome, incredible women cavers that she knew, like all the cavers she knew. She knew so many talented, smart, badass women cavers. And so that's just who ended up getting invited, you know? I think for me at the time as a younger caver, what really was great about that experience was just seeing how many awesome role models there were out there in the caving world. You know, I mean, tons of the women on the trip had PhDs or had started up and ran their own very successful businesses, were just, you know, amazing cavers and had been very prolific in their exploration. You know, it was just a bunch of very, very cool people to meet, especially when, you know, when you are caving, especially at that time, I felt like, you know, I did go on a lot of trips with guys. And so to be able to see yourself, you know, and what you would like to be 10, 20 years down the line, and to be able to cave with some of those women and hear their stories was that part was cool.
That had to have been extremely inspiring.
Yeah. And, I think too, it was very humbling, you know, cause looking at all the other awesome women that were on the trip, it was like, oh wow. Like, what am I doing here? You know, I'm in this amazing cave. It's kind of like feeling like you're in sort of that narrator role or that writer role where you're sort of like kind of watching everybody else like, oh wow, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like all these people are so amazing, you know, and I'm in this amazing cave that, you know, I never thought I would ever have the opportunity to visit. So yeah, from that aspect, it was just such a cool experience.
So there are so many places in Lechuguilla that could be considered breathtaking. Of the places you've been in Lech, what really sticks with you? I mean, you and feel free to say the Chandelier Ballroom, because that's what a lot of people tend to say. But what about Lech has really stuck with you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna be that lame. I mean, actually getting to go through the Chandelier Ballroom, and you know, there's the trails are all marked, and there's only certain places that you can stand. But there's one place where you can stand where you're kind of right by the chandeliers, and it's, you know, again, if Lechuguilla has been kind of a special place for you, or something that you've always thought about, again for me with that background of starting at Carlsbad, yeah, that was kind of a powerful moment for me. To stand there and see the chandeliers up close, and just to be in that space at that time was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, if I ever got to go there, you know, I first learned about Lechuguilla on Planet Earth, and I've read Deep Secrets twice and talked to a lot of Lech cavers. I've never been myself, but if I were going and I knew that on that trip I'd get to either go see or pass through the Chandelier Ballroom, I'd get nervous on my way there. I don't know if that was the same for you, like, oh my God, today's the day I'm going to get to see it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember. Like, I think it actually surprised me, because I had been in Lechuguilla on a few trips and a few camp trips before I went to that part of the cave. And I've never been a big formations person, if that makes sense. Like, I really love being able to see the actual structure and the host rock of the cave itself. And so, I mean, formations are beautiful and they're cool, but I don't know, I've never been much of a formations tourist. And so, you know, I thought about it, and I'm like, oh, cool, the ballroom, you know, I've seen the chandelier graveyard and this, that, and the other thing. But so yeah, I think maybe that's why it's such an impact for me. Like, it's a moment that I think about, because it did take me by surprise a little bit, like getting into the ballroom and seeing the chandeliers and just being there. It's like, wow, I'm getting kind of emotional, you know?
I feel like I would react the same way. Okay, so let's go back. So Carlsbad, you get the job at Carlsbad. Would you say that working at Carlsbad or being there, would you say that that is what hooked you into caving, or had you been hooked prior?
No, that was definitely it. I mean, that I still remember walking into the big room, into the natural entrance and then into the big room, and just seeing, you know, the big room. If you haven't been into the big room in Carlsbad, I totally recommend it. You've got to do it. You've got to walk in the natural entrance and see it. It's just a mind-blowing experience, especially if you grew up, you know, in Michigan and didn't get outside that much growing up. You know, it was a mind-blowing experience. And so it definitely sparked that passion for me. And then getting to actually physically go caving, you know, in wild caves up in Alaska is really what hooked me long term.
Man, the Alaska thing, I got to go back to Alaska. So so you spent a couple of seasons?
So I, let's see, I got my first job up there in 2003, and then I worked up there until 2011.
Oh, okay. So several, my goodness. So several seasons off and on. Were there any years when you skipped Alaska and had something else going on?
No, pretty much. I was in Alaska. I went down to Kentucky. I lived in Kentucky while I was working on my master's. I was in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And then that's kind of how I got hooked into even more caving beyond Alaska.
Of course. Naturally.
I started doing longer trips because the caves in Alaska, we didn't tend to do very long trips. But when I started caving with the Cave Research Foundation in Kentucky, I went on my first kind of longer trips. And then I got invited to go to China as part of my work with the Hoffman Research Institute there at Western Kentucky University. And so I went on my first, really long trip on that expedition to China and got, even more well-versed in vertical caving. I remember I and my other compatriot graduate students doing rebelay after rebelay in stairwells under the watchful eye of Pat Cambyses before we went over to China.
You got to work with Pat. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Pat's amazing. And, I remember when I was learning rebelays there, trying to kind of go through a rebelay with Pat staring at you. And she's like, if you can do it while I'm staring at you, you can do it anywhere. yes. Nervy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she was a great, great mentor and a great teacher there. And, lots of cool experiences there. Met lots of really awesome cavers who I'm still really good friends with. And from there, from Kentucky, we would go down to TAG on the weekends and practice our vertical skills and, cave around Kentucky. So that was a really excellent experience as well. And then I was back up in Alaska, mostly year round for a few years. And then I went, down to Florida and did a PhD from, Tampa. And so got to do some caving in Florida as well.
Okay, so Florida. I know there are caves in Florida, but there's also a lot of springs. Have you ever done the cave diving?
So I got my dive cert while I was down there, and as part of that, there's a couple of caves that they let you dive in with an open water cert. So very minimally, nothing extensive at all. I did the ballroom at Ginny Springs and then a couple of the overhead environment, but not technically caves.
Do you feel like that's something you would like to do?
Yeah, actually, that was something else that surprised me. I thought that cave diving would freak me out more than it did, but it turns out if you're a caver, on the surface, you're a caver underwater too. And so, you put the tanks on, and if you're comfortable with diving, for me, I remember going into the ballroom at Ginny Springs. I was just, that was my first time really ever, and my only time ever really cave diving. And I quickly forgot about all of the other things that, you might be worried about when cave diving, and was just really interested in where all the different pockets and holes went, So yeah, I would be interested in doing more with that, but, haven't had the time. So hopefully someday.
And that's just a whole new set of protocols and everything too. I barely get enough time to go caving you're a different story, but I just feel like that's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, it really is. I think kind of where I got interested and where my interest in cave diving is someday. Obviously I'm only a very new open water cert. I haven't gotten to dive that much, but I did help out with some tank hauls in Kentucky and some other places. And, that was super fun. I enjoyed the camaraderie. We had a whole lot of people there helping out. And, but you get the tanks back to the sump, and then that's kind of where the fun for you ends, and then the divers get to go and actually push the sump. And I love swimming in caves, caves with a lot of water in them are one of my very favorite things to do, And so we get to the part where you get to go swimming, and then we don't get to go, Yeah, I have the interest and I would love to do it, but I definitely don't have any of the experience or skills yet. So maybe someday.
Here's a selfish question. Have you been caving in Indiana?
No, I haven't. And
you got to come.
I work for the Forest Service, and I know that the Hoosier National Forest has just some really great caves on it. And I would love to get out there to the Hoosier one day. I've heard it's pretty excellent. And from, hearing from folks that are from the area and have caved up there, I would love to get there.
And they're open now. Last year from, beginning of May to the end of August, as of last year, they're open to recreational cavers, whereas before WNS closed them down. And so the Hoosier National Forest people have come around, but the state forest management has not yet come around to allowing cavers to go caving. And actually, the state forests in Indiana, I think, have better caves than the national forest land. But the national forest land...
Oh, don't tell me that. No. Oh,
I know. And it's so sad. No, there is a state forest in Indiana called the Harrison Crawford State Forest, and it is just honeycombed with the most incredible caves, but they've been closed to exploration for, well, since 09, I believe, or 08. But yeah, but there's still some great caves in the Hoosier National Forest, and I hope you get a chance to come up here. And of course, plenty of great caves on private land up here as well.
One of my favorite caves is actually just kind of on the border between Indiana and Kentucky, Webster Cave. I got involved with that project through a couple of friends of mine, and it's a fun cave trip. You do, we kayaked through several large lakes back where there was a sump, and then we got to kind of swim through this sump that was just beautiful, and then pop up into a giant borehole, and that's where we started surveying, and that was such a fun cave trip. You know, boating through these giant lakes and seeing gorgeous formations hanging from the ceiling, and then getting to swim through a sump. It was just a super fun trip. And that's right there on the Indiana-Kentucky border. So close, but not quite in Indiana.
I've heard of Webster. And I've heard Yeah, and I've heard of people going there. And that's really, really cool. So you actually dove through a sump.
Well, we didn't dive. There was enough airspace that we could navigate through without diving.
Kind of a ceiling sucker?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think one of my friends videoed it while we were going through, like on one of those little, not an iPhone, but one of the cameras that was waterproof. And I think we measured the time it took us to go through was about 5 minutes. So it's a pretty long sump.
But, oh, it was more like a bathtub.
But yeah, that was a fun trip.
So, what is your longest trip? What is the longest time you've been underground? You said you were about a week in Lechuguilla, longer trips in China.
No, week's probably about it, actually. I'm trying to think, like, I think when we camped in Watla, it was even short. It was maybe 4 or 5 days. I haven't done any of the really long camp trips. They sound like fun, but I haven't had the opportunity to do that yet.
So Watla, who was leading that expedition?
Well, it was on one of Bill Steele's trips that he puts together every
year. I was going to ask if it was Bill.
Yeah, yep.
So did you find anything new down there, or were you just kind of mapping or mopping things up?
Sort of. So we went down there and we got there after a group had gone in and pushed through the Potamahato and gone to a dome that was previously discovered by, I think Bill was down there with Jim Smith like years and years ago. And so a team had gone down before we got there and climbed that dome, but then they left the ropes rigged and it didn't get surveyed. And so they wanted us to go back down and clean up the ropes and survey it. And so we went in to do that, but through varying different things occurring, it ended up just being me and my fiance actually on the trip that went down towards that dome. And we kind of ran out of time, but they had told us that there was another dome on the way there that they thought might be a good target. And so we had all the gear, so we climbed that and kept going, which was really exciting. So they tried to go back last year to continue the climb, but it was flooded, and so they weren't able to get there. So hopefully they're going to send somebody down there this year to check it out.
Oh, goodness. So do you have any plans to go back down to Mexico and join in on more stuff there?
Someday, I hope, but not this year.
Okay, so do you have a grotto affiliation?
I think I have several.
Okay, so where you are now, have you attended any meetings where you live now?
Sort of, maybe. So the Northern Rocky Mountain Grotto is really active, but they only have one meeting a year, which I'm going to miss this year, unfortunately. But I have been out. They sponsor Cave Camp, which they did not do. Let's see. I think they didn't do it last year. They should be doing it again this year because they planned, you know, Northern Rocky Mountain Grotto hosted convention this last year. But they hold this thing called Cave Camp in the fall in October. And it's a really excellent opportunity for cavers to get together and learn things. They host a lot of different educational classes, little snack size classes over the course of a weekend. So there's a half day course on aid climbing. There's a half day course just on basic vertical. There's a half day course on cave GIS. There's a half day course on sketching, or a full day course on some of those things, depending on what you're looking for. And so it really gives cavers an opportunity to be able to learn some of those skills that previously, I think, you know, when I was coming up in caving, you'd have to know somebody that did that and get them to give you the time of day and then go caving with them to learn those things. And now there's this awesome opportunity where you can try anything you want without necessarily having to know somebody, which is, I think, very, very cool. And I wish we had more opportunities like that, you know, for cavers across the country. Or maybe we do, and I haven't heard of them, but it's a really great thing that they pull together. And it's really affordable. I don't remember how much it costs, but I remember thinking that for all you get for the weekend, you get your lodging, they feed you. Oftentimes, there's also beer. You get a t-shirt, plus all that awesome training. It's a great weekend. And it's kind of in the middle of Montana, so it's a little bit of a trek to get there, but it's totally worth it.
And forgive me, what part of the country do you live in?
So that's a really good question.
I'm sure it changes year to year. Well, maybe not year to year, but every once in a while.
Yeah, so I've been living in Denver for the past 7 years or so. And so while I was there, I'd go to both the Colorado Grotto and Front Range Grotto meetings. So those are probably the last grottos that I was super affiliated with. And then right now I've been in northern Idaho. My fiance and I live here right now, but I'm going on a detail to a different part of the country. I'll be down in Oregon for the next four months. So I kind of bop around a lot. I think I'm also still, of course, a member of the Glacier Grotto up in Alaska.
And so that must have been how you got involved with the Idaho's Middle Earth production, right?
No, actually, that was through work. I had never... I'm trying to think. I'd driven through Idaho years and years ago, but I'd never really spent time in Idaho until I got to come up here for that production. That was actually in my work as the National Cave and Karst Program lead for the Forest Service. One of the geologists for the Payette National Forest, Jim Agnew, called me up and had said that the Idaho Public Television crew, they'd done a show, and gosh, I want to say it was like 20 years before that or 15 years before that time period, which was really impressive. And so I went back and watched their work and was really impressed for the time when they did it, you know, and how much people knew about caves back then. Their conservation message was really great. It was an excellent program. And so I agreed to go up there and work with them on that. And so that was actually through my work with the Forest Service.
Well, and yeah, and to fill everybody in, so Idaho's Middle Earth was an episode of, it's like Idaho Outdoor or something like that, that the Idaho PBS affiliates produced themselves. And you mentioned the respect that they gave the cave. They didn't mention the name of the cave once, which I was really impressed by, because most of the time, that sort of thing, they're, you know, if you have a film crew there, they want to know where it is, what it's called, and all that. But they really paid a lot of respect to these sort of caving rules that not a lot of people know about, as in, we're not going to tell you, we're not going to tell you what it's called. You can come, you can film, but you have to follow these rules. I thought that was really cool of them.
I mean, just their willingness to listen to the folks that were there from the grotto, as well as to myself and the others that were there from the Forest Service. And yeah, their attention to detail and their willingness to learn. They got on rope with the folks from the grotto, and so they had to learn SRT skills and go through the same process that other cavers would go through to show that they knew what they were doing before going in. And they were a really great team.
It was so well done. I mean, it's so easy to screw up a documentary about caves because it's so hard to get everything in there and working. Was that tough to film?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the, if you watch it, a lot of the program that was done in the cave that I was part of, you'll see they'll show a lot of pictures, and that's because some of the filming just didn't work out so great. But I still think that they did a really great job.
They really did. It was really something. Okay, so you mentioned your official title, National Cave and Karst Program Coordinator for the U.S. Forest Service. You want to share some of the genesis of that?
Yeah, so I was working as a geologist and a karst specialist on the Tongass National Forest, and I'd been there for a few years, and they flew the... advertised the position with the Washington Office Minerals and Geology Management for the Forest Service. And at the time, the agency had had folks in the recreation program that were half-time managing caves and karst, and the geology program had just reorganized and was looking at bringing folks in to address, you know, paleontological resources and geologic hazards. And so one of the positions they wanted to bring on was somebody to address caves and karst. And at the time, they didn't really have a good understanding of what that meant in terms of the workload, in terms of what needed done on the ground from the geology perspective on the national scale specifically. And there's a whole lot more that goes into that in terms of how we were organized previously. We had regional geologists at the regional level that were dealing with some of that, you know. So it's not that that wasn't getting addressed. It was just being kind of done in a different way structurally. And so when I stepped into the role, it was somewhat new and somewhat different, and just figuring out what that meant and what we did need to address and what things we needed to work on was an interesting process and a fun process. And then having the opportunity to be able to work with folks, especially to work with our National Speleological Society partners, already knowing some of the awesome cavers out there and the folks that have a lot of passion around what they're doing on National Forest System lands, it was great to have the opportunity to work with those people and to support the great stuff that they're doing out on the landscape.
Caves Live, was this your idea?
Yeah, actually, it was.
Well, you're the top of the list of the producers, and so I assumed as much.
It's sort of. So I will take a step back and say that the Forest Service Nature Live family of programs has been going on for a really long time. And so to do a caves-specific live show was sort of my, hey, you know, do you think we could make this happen? I think this would be great. Do you guys think this would be great? You know, so that was sort of my effort. But the way the programs are structured and the live broadcast and the Q&A and all of that stuff is really the brainchild of, Sandy Frost. She's a partnership specialist with the Watershed Fish Wildlife Air and Rare Plants Group in the Forest Service, and Kim Winter, who's the Nature Watch Program Manager for the Forest Service, and then our partners there, Prince William Network from Prince William County Schools in Washington, D.C., and so many other people invented the template, if you will. And then I was able to bring caves to that table, which was great.
It's a cool doc for sort of introducing cave science. Why was the cave portion of it, the produced portion, why was that in Arkansas? I mean, you did the live portion at Luray Caverns in Virginia, hence the talking with the D.C. schools folks. Did you just happen to be there and all the people ended up there, or other reasons?
No, other reasons. So the D.C. folks there, the Prince William County Schools, Prince William Network that we work with, they actually have done work, you know, across the country from Alaska to Puerto Rico. And then there's also been some international work, like with Grasslands Live. Grasslands Live was the program they did right before Caves Live, and they did some international work between Mexico and the U.S. They filmed down in Mexico. So they're kind of go all over. But the reason why we picked Blanchard Springs Caverns in Arkansas was because we wanted to showcase one of our beautiful Forest Service caves. So we were able to go down there and just kind of check the area out and meet with Shane Avey, who's the caverns manager down there. He's incredible. They have done some really awesome things with the facility as well as the cave itself. And so we just had a really great opportunity to film somewhere where we weren't going to impact a cave that hadn't already been impacted, you know, with tourist trails and things like that. There's a walkway through the cave. There's already lights and things. And so, and to also showcase just an awesome Forest Service cave.
So then why Luray? Was it just a geographic convenience to D.C.?
No. So we were also partnering with the National Caves Association. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but it's a National Association of Show Caves. And so, I think a couple of Park Service caves might be members. I know Forest Service Blanchard Springs Caverns is a member. So we reached out to Luray as part of working with that awesome network of show caves. And they were willing to have us come in. And then the film crew from Prince William Network had actually worked in Luray, again, you know, years and years previously. They had filmed something there before. And so they knew that they would be able to do a live show from there, which it's no easy thing to do a live show from inside a cave.
You pulled it off. It was really great. I mean, not only the produced portion done at Blanchard Spring, but the thing at Luray, the Q&A with the middle school kids, it was a really, really cool, like, I could really feel that they were interested, and they were asking some really great questions.
Yeah, they really were. And I'll have to take a step back again and say, you know, I was kind of the head of the project from the Forest Service side, but Richard Shahan and Christy Lyric from the Prince William Network side were the ones really making magic happen. Richard has done a lot of videography for a lot of different things professionally and has put together, I think he's done every single one of those FS Nature Live shows, as well as a whole other body of work. And so it was really his skill set and his team and Christy's logistical talents, just pulling everything together and making that all happen. So I was just a piece of a much, much larger entity of which Richard and Christy were at the helm of the ship of. So it was just a truly incredible team. But yeah, so the middle school that they had come out and work with us, those kids were awesome and they had such great questions. And then we had so many questions coming in, you know, from all over the place. It was hard to answer them all. And that was the exciting part, was to kind of hear some of the really interesting and in depth and insightful, I think is the word that I'm looking for, questions that some of the kids have. I mean, kids, I learned that early on from doing cave tours, is that you can get some pretty hard questions to answer from some pretty serious 6-year-olds.
Is there anything else that you kind of wanted to cover? Any other fun things that you like to share when you're talking caving? Maybe perhaps after a few beers, what stories come out of you when the conditions are right?
Maybe you'll have to buy me a few beers.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, some good stories that come out. A lot of the funny stories that I can think of come from China expeditions, but I'm not sure how many of them would necessarily translate to people that haven't been part of it, you know? So I'm just kind of trying to think of, like...
So China, what did you get to see there? Did you get to see some of... I mean, I've heard about some of the big stuff that's been found in China. Were you a part of any of that?
I guess marginally. I was, you know, I was on a lot of expeditions over there, and I'm trying to think if that was the most recent one. I was over in the Ranjigo area, and we got to map in the cave where Cloud Ladder Hall is. But, you know, I wasn't there for the discovery of that, but I did get to see it on one of the trips that there was in, and that's one of the larger cave rooms in the world. I forget where it's at now, as they've started really mapping things out.
Hazel actually talked to me about that, because she was one of the first people in there. I mean, so you've been in there. I mean, what was that like for you? I mean, knowing caves, to step into a place like that, that's got its own weather and it's enormous. What was that like?
It's a pretty big experience. It's a pretty awesome thing. I think when I was there, on some level, you know, when she was there and they were shooting pictures and things, I think maybe they got like a better sense of it, just because we didn't have anybody on rope when I was in there. We came in through the bottom. You know, at some point, it's just kind of too massive for you to comprehend, right? Like, it's almost a bigger experience to be in a chamber where you have a ton of water moving through and you can feel it vibrating in your chest. Like, that's kind of, that's a heavy experience. But I mean, it was just that amazing amount of darkness above you is in some ways hard to comprehend, right? Without having something for scale or some lights or something, you know. But knowing it was there is something too.
Like, when it's something like that, it's just like you can't quite wrap your brain around it, because you couldn't have wrapped your brain around it in the moment. And it's almost so much that you can't have even processed it fully after the fact.
But I guess, you know, so many of the caves in China are so huge. And I mean, that I don't want to say that and diminish some of those really large cave rooms, you know, but the scale of caves in China and in Asia in general, they're just so huge, you know, a little bit more hugeness, a little bit more expanse, you know, without the lights to kind of really see the scale, or having been through it maybe yourself, just seeing a part of it wouldn't necessarily hit you as much.
Okay, so where do you like to go to recreationally cave? There's no agenda, there's no... you don't have to do any survey, you don't have to do any science, you don't have to do anything, you're just there.
What do you mean I don't have to survey? That's the best part.
Okay, so if that, so if for you that's the best part, then there we go. So I guess I'm asking you that dreaded, awful newbie question, where are your favorite caves?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Alaska is definitely where my heart is. The caves there, mapping those caves, looking at them as part of, you know, a larger area, figuring out how they all fit together. I mean, that's where I started, and I hope that that's where I get to spend the bulk of my time, is caving there. That's totally where my heart is.
You're also an NSS fellow.
I am, yes.
As of 2014?
I think so, yeah.
What has that done for you? I mean, who got you that accolade?
I don't know that, I don't think anybody told me. I mean, I think I have some, you know, I think you kind of know that some people wrote some letters for you, but that's not so much part of the process, right? I mean, it's just, and I think that's kind of a cool thing in that, you know, when you get the fellow and you're standing there at convention, if you are able to go and receive it at convention, which I totally think you should, you know, when you get it, it's just this feeling like you're supported by the community, which is really, really cool. And that, you know, you have no idea how many people or who nominated you and what they wrote. You don't get to see the letters or anything like that. So it's just this really cool anonymous feeling of the society lifting you up and supporting what you've done and the work and the things that you've done. It's just, that's a cool feeling. So aside from the awesome secret handshake, you know, it's just being able, it's just kind of that reaffirmation that, you know, the things that you're doing, the passion that you have is going towards a greater cause.
Johanna Kovarik, thank you for spending some time with us, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
As did I. I hope you, the listener, did as well. Thanks again, Johanna. And thank you for listening. You know, we talked a lot about Hazel Barton in this episode, so I guess now's a great time to tell you that she'll be my guest next month. I'm so glad I got to talk with Hazel. I cannot wait for you to hear it. Look, have a great time at convention. Oh, and if you see Charlie down there, Charlie Vetters with Organic Robot Designs, remember to ask him for a free caving podcast sticker. He'll have 200 of them to give out, but only if you ask. You can also get a caving podcast t-shirt. Half the proceeds from that go toward my bandwidth and hosting fees. That big annual bill's coming up for me next month. Of course, Charlie makes the best caving-related shirts you can buy, and he'll have new designs ready for convention. So check out his stuff there. Or at the Organic Robot Etsy shop if you won't be at convention. A big thanks, as always, to Swego, too, for, again, floating me through Fredericksburg Cave last month and for supporting the podcast. Once a sponsor, always a sponsor. That's how it works around here. I just love all you guys. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.